the Wildlife Observer Network.
Let me know when you're recording.
All right. I think we are back.
Okay.
Dan's new internet failed him, and he is back with us. So we're just asking about the barbet he discovered, and I wanted to know if did anybody locally know about it? Is it sympatric with other barbets that look similar? Although he sounds like this is pretty distinctive. I was saying, how could you grab your book, but it's being used for another purpose right now.
It's probably supporting a leg of a table or something, right?
No, it's for a photo shoot for something ridiculous. You probably missed that. Yeah. I'm recreating the Scarface Mountains of Cocaine picture, but with mountains of prison field guides.
This has been long planned. I'm very eager to see. It's going to be
Okay. Interesting. Are you going to have like torn up pages around your face then?
I was trying to figure out what to do about the nose. You know, and I don't know.
You could have like, you know, when post shaving, when you put little bits of paper to cover up the blood, you could do something like that. Yeah. Well, to answer your question. So where we actually found the bird was on a mountain that, as far as I could tell, had actually not been visited by people. And it was up in the crown of the mountain above the habitat that was sort of, that goes down to the river where there would have been some traffic. But on the crown of the mountain, we found no evidence of people having been up there. So at that site, I would say no one probably was aware of the bird, although possibly, you know, who knows how many millennia, there may have been local folks who may have gone up there for religious ceremonies or something at one point and seen the bird. I don't know. But it wasn't for another 12 years that the bird, this same barbet, was then found in another site, which was the first place away from the original locality where it had been found, by my friend Todd Mark, who's a pretty intrepid explorer. And his discovery then led to it, the little town of Plataforma, or as it's known now, the Flor de Café, being a tourist attraction. The barbet is now one of the main things that draws the attention of tourists to come in and visit. And that town, I guess, was established sometime in the early to mid 80s. And I would imagine that the locals probably were aware of the bird because it's pretty noteworthy. But whether or not they had a name for it, I have no idea. So that's actually something I've never, should ask them, see if they have any lore about that bird. But the town is a fairly new town. So, and the people there, the purpose for them being there basically is to grow sun coffee. So it's actually something that's not really an excellent.
Yeah, not the best.
Yeah, an excellent agricultural product for the benefit of birds and so on, which is unfortunate. But that's a different conversation, I guess. But in any event, so the bird, it was just sort of happenstance that I was the second of the ornithologists on that particular expedition to visit the cloud forest on the crown of the mountain. The first, Andy Cratter, to be fair to his not having seen it, it was because when he was there, they were still cutting the path that led up there. And so the one day he managed to get up into that habitat, he was literally right behind the guys who were cutting the trail up into the forest. And chances are that birds probably were scared away by that activity, the disturbance. And he was up there kind of midday when activity would have been at its lull, you know?
Yeah.
So he just was dealt a poor hand in order to have had the opportunity to see the bird first. So it was just really a kind of a stroke of luck, but it also just so happened that the day before that we had a satellite camp that was about 3 or 4 kilometers from the peak on a ridge down below it, where there was still some water. Of course, that's a important thing for a camp, is to have water for cooking and drinking. The day before, I think it was raining pretty much all day. So I stayed in my tent, and the only field guide I had was the Birds of Columbia. So I was leafing through that. And I knew at the time that all of the barbets known in Peru would be in the field guide of Birds of Columbia. And so when I saw the barbet, I had actually looked at the barbet plate that other day. So when I finally saw the barbet, I knew it was not one of the birds on that plate. So it was kind of a couple of lucky strokes that I had there that allowed me to be the first person to see it, and also to be the first person to recognize it was almost certainly new.
What was your first view of that bird like?
Well, the very first view, actually, I had been just kind of hiking up into this cloud forest. It was kind of a cool place because this mountain is one of the first mountains that the humid winds coming off the Amazon would hit. And so there was this really hard line in the forest, and below which it was kind of standard lowland tropical rainforest, and above which it was really moss covered. I mean, you could walk and see the line on the trees, below which there was no epiphytes and above which there was. And so it was really kind of wild just to walk up into this. It's kind of hard to explain, but it was a neat habitat. And shortly after getting up into this habitat, there was this massive mixed species flock. And I was just kind of spinning around and just having a grand old time seeing things, a lot of new birds for me and stuff. And this was my first trip to South America, mind you.
This is what, 1996.
Okay. It's a hold up. How do you end up going to a place that basically never been, hardly any human beings have ever been to, let alone ornithologists, on your first trip to South America?
Well, you joined the old LSU Museum of Natural Science. That's how. basically, what had happened, I mean, so we're going to go sort of back up here a little bit then. I had found out about this program here at LSU when I was about 12 through an article that was in Audubon magazine that highlighted the new discoveries that John O'Neill and Ted Parker had been making in Peru. And that was news to me. I was blown away by the idea that there were still new species of birds to be discovered. I figured that, all birds were known at that point, which I guess most people had thought. And so when I found out about the LSU program, I was like, that's what I want to do with my life. So that's when I started taking biology. I started taking Spanish, kind of sort of directed my middle school and high school decisions specifically so that I would be as well prepared as I could be to apply to become a grad student here at LSU, which just happened to work out pretty well. And I came down to LSU in my senior year of college. I interviewed with Van Remsen, who would be my major professor. And I also made a point of visiting with John O'Neill, who of course had been a hero of mine forever. He's a bird artist. I'm sort of a bird artist. And so I also brought some sketch pads and a couple of examples of my art. And he invited me to come out to his house, and we spent an afternoon just talking birds and art and all that. And I guess we got along really well. I certainly thought we did anyway. And when I got back to college after the visit down here for whatever it was, 4 or 5 days, I got an email from Van, who told me to contact John because he had a question for me. So I phoned up John O'Neill, and this was before John was even aware that I'd been accepted by LSU as a student. But John asked me if I would be interested in joining his next expedition to South America. So after I picked myself up off the floor from a heart attack, I said yes. and basically the rest was history. It was originally supposed to be in 1995, but it was pushed back a year, and thankfully so, because that gave me a year to learn how to skin birds and to take some classes and to actually review the specimens at the museum here and learn sort of the birds that are likely to be where we're going. I compiled cassettes back in the 90s. We were still using cassettes of playback, so I had an idea of what I was listening for, stuff like that. So I actually had a year to really prepare myself for it, and it apparently worked out pretty well. So yeah, that's how that happened. It wasn't an accident that we were there. Basically, John is somebody who has always had a really good nose for spots to visit where there's a chance for finding something new. He's had a very illustrious career in discovering and describing new species. I think he's involved in 14 new species to science. I think the only person who might outstrip him maybe is Brett Whitney, mm-hmm. who I think is presently somewhere around 16 or 17, but I can't really remember.
So I got to know, Dan, because I have known you for years, but I've never actually heard you tell the story. Like I asked you before, what was your first view? So you're going through this forest, you've got...
Yeah, so I guess I didn't quite get to that, did I? So yeah. So I was in the midst of this mixed species flock, and while, you know, I had my... I'm really big into sound recording, so I had my cassette recorder on, and I think I had my binoculars in my left hand and my microphone in my right hand, and was kind of just trying to get recordings of whatever I could at the time. And this bird landed in a tree over my head, and I looked at it, and all I could see was part of its face through the leaves. And all I could see was a black mask with a white eyebrow and a reddish crown. And of the birds expected in that area, the only thing that fit that description, as far as I knew, was this little woodpecker called a yellow-vented woodpecker, which is kind of related to our downy and hairy woodpeckers. And so I just assumed that's what it was, which is kind of ironic because we actually never found that bird in reality. So then I sort of continued watching other birds in the flock. And then this bird that had been kind of hidden above me dropped down on an open branch at eye level right in front of me and just sat there and just kind of blew my mind. And I happened to have the microphone on while this was happening. So if you were to go to Zeno Canto or to Macaulay Library, I think, too, the recording of the moment of discovery is there. So I actually realized it was a new bird while the mic was on.
Wow. That's
so it's on there. And I'm amazed I didn't curse, but, obviously you'll hear that I was fairly excited. But I managed to pretty much keep my cool, I think. I guess you could decide for yourself if you want. But it was kind of a mind-blowing thing. And I guess to me, in some respects, that was both the best and worst thing that could ever have happened to me, because obviously it's exciting to find a new bird, and especially a bird that is just so mind-blowingly new and so obviously new.
Right. Looks like nothing else.
It looks, there's a second story to that, but we'll get to that in a second. But least at the time, there was nothing else that looked like it. But it happened when I was 22, and like that was the goal of my life. So, you know, it's been downhill from there pretty much. So it's like, you know, what else is there to look forward to? That's not supposed to happen to you when you're 22 years old, you know?
Pack it in, man. You're done.
Exactly.
Career's over in 1996.
So it hadn't even started. It was already done. But the interesting thing was that I actually wrote an article for Neotropical Birding on this bird. So there, if anyone's interested, you can take a look there. It's the one of the publications of the Neotropical Bird Club. I can't remember what year it is, but I think it was around 2012. I wrote it. And the interesting thing is that, our common friends, Glenn Seeholzer and Mike Harvey, found, and Ben Winger, I guess, found a very similar looking barbet, another isolated mountain range in Peru. And so, you know, people might ask, well, why did you have to collect specimens? You know, this is such an obvious bird. What would even be necessary to collect specimens? Well, now suddenly you have another bird that looks just like it. So having the specimens, in fact, was really important in order to be able to distinguish the two, find out if they're even, you know, the same taxon or if they're two different taxa. It's still not clear whether they're the same species or not. They're right. Really very similar.
Obviously very, very closely related.
Right? Yeah. So, I mean, they're kind of right on the knife edge between species and subspecies.
I've since found your book. It wasn't actually that buried in the stack. And
you got a Jenga set of like bird books over there is what I'm
picturing. Well, it's everything I have from Princeton. So, I mean, it's close to 100 books, easy. Yeah. It's not over it. And, I haven't found, so that other species of barbet is not in the,
Well, that book was published in 2007, which I think they found their bird in 2008. And I think it was described to science around 2010 or 11. And our second edition only came out in 2010. So our book predated the description of their bird. So it's not included in the book, but I am hopeful to get another edition out soon being like in the next 10 years. And that bird will be in there too.
I think that's something folks don't realize is that once you actually make the discovery, the describing it to science is something that can take, you know, it does take longer, and it can take quite a long time. Even how long did it take you to describe this barbet? And then maybe give us a little sketch on a couple of the other birds that you have.
Yeah, described. Well, this barbet was actually, for its time, I think one of the quicker descriptions, partly because it was so obviously new that there was really little discussion among reviewers about, you know, how can you tell this is new kind of thing.
Right.
It took us 4 years to get that paper out. So the bird was discovered in 1996.
Right? That's a relatively straightforward.
That's pretty quick. We've actually beaten that since. In fact, it was 2016, the 20-year anniversary of the discovery of the barbet. Some friends and I went to this place I was describing, Plataforma, where Todd Mark had found the bird, because I hadn't seen it again since the original discovery. So we went there to see the barbet again.
That was with Jesse Fagan and
that was with Jesse. That was with Fernando Angulo and Oscar Johnson and Andre. We're both students here at LSU. And we had just finished an expedition into the lowlands of Peru, kind of northeast of there. And actually, Oscar, I guess, hadn't joined us on that first trip. But we decided we wanted I really wanted to go back and find, see the barbet after 20 years. And there was a couple other birds up there of interest. I've been hearing all about this spot and really wanted to see what it was about. So we went up, and it's a horrible road getting into this place, but you can get in by, you know, 4x4. And we arrived sort of towards evening of, you know, whatever day it was. And there was a gringo who was sitting there waiting apparently for the vehicle to arrive, because he wanted to jump in the vehicle and go back down to town. But when he saw us, he was like, "Oh, are you guys birders?" And we're like, "Yeah, we're here to you know, see the barbet and so on." He's like, "Oh, okay." And we introduced ourselves. And when he found out I was Dan Lane, he must have recognized my name from the book cover. And he's like, "Oh, I've got a question for you. I've found an ant bird, and you know, I wonder if you'd be able to help me identify it." And you know, people ask me that kind of stuff all the time, so I figured it was just going to be a recording, and I would just tell him what it was, and that'd be that. He played the recording. And as soon as he started singing, I was like, "Whoa, that is a new species." And so he just started describing, he actually saw the bird. It was on the ground, which is fairly unusual for ant birds. And it was walking, which is really unusual for ant birds. There's actually only a few ant birds that walk. And so between the song type and the fact that he saw it walking, I was pretty sure I knew what it was likely to be. It was going to be a new species related to a bird called the fruginous-backed ant bird, which is found in northeastern South America. So like over 1,000 kilometers away. And we're like, "Well, you know," he's like, "Well, I was going to go down to town to see if I could find anybody who was going to help me. I don't have my camera with me. All I was able to do was make this recording on my cell phone. I was hoping that maybe someone would help me document the bird." And we kind of all looked at each other like, "Well, we are here set to document things. So, you know, if you're willing."
Kind of what we do.
So he took us back there the next day. And, you know, we actually struggled to try to find the bird immediately, but we eventually got it. And sure enough, I mean, this thing is, you know, again, slap you in the face new. It's kind of amazing.
And what's
the first member of this group of ant birds that's known from the Andes. So it's pretty amazing. And so, yeah. You know, 20 years after the discovery of the barbet, trying to sort of follow up on the barbet, we kind of stumble into this situation where we're involved in discovering and describing another really obvious new species. And that one, Andre Moncrief took the lead on pulling together that paper. I should mention the fellow who found it, by the way, is Josh Beck, who's a real talented birder who's been traveling all around the Neotropics the past few years. And so Josh is a co-author, as were everyone else who was in that group. And Oscar Johnson and I went back several months later to a nearby site so we could find it again. And published, I think, between discovery and...
Looks like we lost Dan again.
Yeah. So, I wonder if he realizes that. Is it down to two yet? It still says three. It's unfortunate. I was afraid of that. I kind of heard it coming and I was like, oh, yeah. Hang on.
Well, we got a lot of good stuff so far. Yeah, he's gone completely now.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to you can record on Zoom yourself.
Yeah.
If you get I'm going to have to go do fatherly duties.
Okay.
Oh, it looks like he's coming back. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, good. I don't have to re-enter. So I'm you can hear me again?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Cool. Yeah, I just reconnected it. This I hope it's not going to do this regularly. Jesus. Sorry about that.
It's okay. Tony was just saying he's got what? How, I don't know how much time you got.
I mean, I could probably do at least 10 more minutes.
Okay.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. Well, yeah. Why don't we? Once you see sort of the number getting down low, why don't we just sort of pause and pick it up again? Huh?
Yeah.
But, yeah. Okay. So, but I hope you got my full last thought there.
Yeah. Well, we kind of heard that you had worked on the paper with Oscar. I'm not sure how to resume that one. I don't know where we were.
Exactly. Well,
the okay, ant bird and then the
yeah. Did you hear me say that basically the long and short of it is that paper came out about a year and a half after the discovery of the bird, which I would imagine is probably the quickest turnaround in publication from discovery of certainly any modern discovered bird. Because of the length of time needed to assemble all the information and then go through the review process and publication process.
Yeah. So, what about like genetic, someone's doing like a, you know, running a tree and, you know, what about splits? Like, you know, DNA, genetic splits, like some birds have been found that way. I wonder if any of those have been pretty fast turnarounds because, you know, it's not like a.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you mean birds that had already been described or birds that hadn't already been described but were discovered because of
genetics? Or like, you know, like a subspecies that someone ran the genetics on and realized is a full species, warrants a full species, yeah, things yeah. like that.
Well, so that sort of thing, you know, that I don't know how you would actually quantify when that would have been discovered, you know, because that kind of discovery, I'd say, kind of gels in the process of writing, you know, while you're assembling the information, you know, creating the trees and so on. I would say very few people could probably run a gel and know almost immediately that that's going to be a new species because you have to crunch numbers. And then you also have to sort of, once you build the tree part actually takes quite a bit. There's a lot of computer, you know, work done there that basically you have to feed the information into a series of computers that are linked. And then they crunch numbers for like 3 days or something and build these trees and often build multiple different trees. And you're selecting the trees that kind of best tell the story, of what you think is going on or select the trees that share the most characters that the whole crop of trees have. I don't know if that makes sense, but so, there isn't really quite the same eureka moment there that you would have in some of these field cases that I've just outlined. But really the publication of the paper between that and then the recognition of this taxon being a new species, it's really the time between the publication of the paper and when a committee like, you know, the AOU SAC committee or IOC or something then publishes their next update and makes that split sort of official, if you will. It's not, I don't know if you really can really say there's a, you know, the same kind of stop clock way of saying how long it takes. Process. Yeah. So, but there've been a couple of other different kinds of discoveries that I've played a role in, which I thought were kind of cool. Like, so those were both cases where it involved actually recognizing the newness of a bird at the time of observation. which is probably the purest form of discovery, I guess.
Yeah.
But then there was a case where I had just come back from an expedition in northern Peru where we'd found this population of a bird called Rufus cassiornis, which is kind of a small, all Rufus flycatcher. It's kind of like a great crested flycatcher. It's in that group of flycatchers. George probably is familiar with it from Argentina and Bolivia.
Yes. Yeah.
And so there's a little pocket of them in northern Peru, which is kind of unusual. And so I was visiting the museum in Lima to just see what they already had in their collection there, and opened the drawer that had Rufus cassiornis written on the side. And in that drawer, there was a Rufus cassiornis that had actually been traded to that museum via LSU. It was actually a specimen that had been collected in Bolivia, and we then traded to the Lima Museum. And then there was a second bird that was also identified as Rufus cassiornis, but it was easily a third larger, had really shaggy textured plumage and a different bill shape, and just wasn't a Rufus cassiornis. You know, it was really...
You're looking at this thing and you're like, what the hell is this?
Exactly. Like, I looked at that bird and I think my mind must have gone blank for a few seconds, just like shocked that this thing just didn't ring a bell. And I'd say this was in about 2002. I would say at that point, I was fairly familiar with most birds in Peru. I mean, obviously there's still quite a few I haven't seen, but I'd gotten experience with a few, and I certainly knew even birds I hadn't already seen. I knew most of them. And the book hadn't been published yet at that point, though. But I was looking at this bird, and it just wasn't ringing any bells. And so I started kind of looking at it more critically just to see if I could sort out what it might be. And looking at the wing shape and looking at, you know, how shaggy the plumage was and a couple other characters, I decided that it had to be in the genus Nipodectes. And there, at that time, there was only one species in that genus that was called at the time the brownish flycatcher. Now it's called brownish twistwing.
Yeah, much better name.
Yeah. But that was the only species known to be in that genus. And this thing was bigger than that. They actually had specimens of that at the collection there too. So I could actually hold them side by side. And this thing was, again, about a third bigger. And it was just all super saturated rufous in color. And so that sort of led, that was the start of another discovery that led to the description of a bird called the Rufus twistwing, which we described in 2007. So, and that was a case where I never actually saw the bird alive until I think 6 years after describing it.
Yeah. You've taken a little bit of a beating from some of your colleagues for the scientific name, the Super Rufa.
Super Rufus. Yeah. Yeah. I've had a couple of people tell me they thought that was a dumb name, but you know, I don't think so. I think it's a pretty neat name, frankly.
I think it's colorful. I think a lot of these names, you know, are just, you know, people opt for like the most boring name. Tony and I have talked about, Tony created a list of alternative bird names for some of these North American birds.
Well, Dan, yeah, just well aware. In fact, I proposed it, you know, I took a first pass as it. A lot of it was jokes and in-jokes, or the name out of desperation just as a challenge to do it all. And Dan, more than any other person who responded to that, suggested names. I mean, I got tons of feedback, like, you know, hundreds of messages. Dan,
I do recall.
The most thorough one, and so the final list, I incorporated pretty much every one of Dan's suggestions because they were excellent.
Oh, thanks.
He's going to have 10 minutes.
That was interesting. That was definitely an interesting exercise, I have to say. Made me think quite a bit. How are we doing on time?
10 minutes on this Zoom. And then that's okay. If you guys want to go longer, you guys can do a Zoom yourselves, and then we'll lump all the file, put all the files together.
We just got a little bit of time left. I got kind of a couple of topics that we discussed beforehand. I thought we could just kind of run through, get some quick takes from Dan on a couple of these, if that sounds all right.
Yeah, sure.
Tony, you had raised this new Rufus antpitta split, which, if people don't know, Rufus antpitta is a bird that is a South American bird found from what, Colombia on down to at least Bolivia, right?
I don't know. Yeah, just barely makes into Venezuela, but yeah, mostly Colombia to Bolivia, yeah.
And people have known for years that there's multiple species involved because they, even though they look kind of similar, they have different habits, different voices. Dan, what do you think is the coolest part about this paper that just announced it's split into how many species?
It's 16 species. Yeah. You know, kind of amazing. I think part of the coolest thing is, well, for one thing, this project had been a monster that was started by Gary Graves back in like 1990 or something. And in the end, he actually gave up on it because it was just too big for him to handle. And so it fell to Mort Eisler and Terry Chesser and a group of other folks. And it's actually two different papers that were published simultaneously that kind of complement one another. Mort did the taxonomic part and Terry was in charge of the phylogenetics that sort of provided the support for the change in the taxonomy. And the phylogenetics and the voices both indicated that the number of subspecies at that time recognized for Rufus ampeta, which was like 10, I think, was underestimating by quite a bit. So actually it was less. I think it was like 8. Anyway, it had to be doubled. It was so now 16 species level taxa, at least according to the author team, with I think one additional subspecies level taxa. And it's just kind of a monster of a study. It's kind of amazing that it's finally done. I know a lot of people had been waiting somewhat impatiently, perhaps, for this thing to come out. So I'm sure the authors are just relieved it finally did. And it's just kind of wild to imagine that from a bird where there was one species extending the full length of the tropical Andes to now recognizing it's actually very small distributions for most of these populations. And so Colombia, I think, got something like...
Got a couple endemics, at least.
Yeah, got like six species are found in Colombia and 10 are found in Peru now.
Yeah, and the names are cool, too. Like
Well, the Colombian ones particularly have some neat names. That were named, I think, for like local Indian tribes or something.
Yes. Yeah.
So yeah, really, really neat stuff. That was, I think, largely thanks to my bud Andres Cuervo and Daniel Cadena, who were really the ones who drove the Colombian part of that study. And so it's just a cool result all around. I think I know that my Peruvian friends are really jazzed to know that Peru made out better than Colombia in that split, because the two countries kind of are vying for, who has more birds. And
Global big day. It's like those two are like duking it out, and Colombia's had the better. So Dan, we're running out of time, but I was a couple other ones I wanted to hit on. The AOS president, I don't know, Tony, if you heard about this.
I heard about this. Yes, on Facebook.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So the AOS president resigned this last week over a quote unquote scandal of removing a cowbird egg from a white-eyed vireo nest. What's like a two sentence takeaway on that? What the heck happened there?
Well, I actually was just discussing this with Van Remsen and a couple other folks here, and Van is certain that the story is actually legit. Apparently Tom Sherry posted something to Facebook about having removed this egg, and people commented that actually is an illegal act. And I think that he just felt that it was something that could damage the reputation of the AOS. And that was his reason for resigning before he actually took the presidency. Apparently he's somebody who is that sort of straight laced. So
if so, that's pretty admirable. The swallow in Texas, the reported blue and white swallow, do the photos establish its identity beyond a reasonable doubt? Yes or no?
Beyond a reasonable doubt, I would probably have to say not quite. So no, I suppose, but I'm sure it warms up to the idea.
Yeah, Tony, I'm sure you've seen the pics. They're not great, but it is certainly a very intriguing bird.
This must be. I got the AOS president scandal, but the blue and white swallow must have dropped mid new baby or when I was in the hospital, because I missed that one.
Yeah,
no, that was just like in the past 3 to 4 days.
Yeah, just a couple days ago.
Yeah, I'm still I'm still in the thick of it, but yes.
Oh, well, by the way, I didn't say I wanted to congratulate you.
I know. That was my thing I wanted to do first off, and I forgot to do it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Tyke and I did a podcast right before this one where we talked about that a lot. So, but yeah, so in the course of thank you. And you talked to me personally, George, before we recorded. Yeah, guys, it's been awesome. It's sleep deprived as people say it will be, but it's completely wonderful.
Yeah.
All right. Well, excellent. Well done. It's
a beautiful name. It really is.
Well, thank you.
One last one for Dan. Dan, what is your jinx bird?
Wow. I'm not sure I can come up with one off the top of my head.
Is there? There must be something that you want to see in Peru you have not seen yet.
Actually, yeah. I guess the bird I would really like to see. I haven't tried for it yet, so I don't know if it really counts as a jinx, but the orange-throated tanager. I'd like to see that in Peru rather than in Ecuador, where it's easier to see at the moment. But I've never seen the bird at all.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember what the gene is. Is that the Wetmore?
Wetmore thraupus. Yeah, that's the bird that started everything here at LSU. And
that's right. Yeah, I can see why you'd want to see that.
But here in Louisiana, there's a black-whiskered vireo down at Grand Isle right now that I've yet to see that in the state. And I'm tempted to go down there, but at the same time, you know, the sort of coronavirus thing is just, you know, especially on weekends, that'd be a terrible place to go down. So I'm sort of playing with the idea of doing it, but I haven't done it yet. And it's probably, the time is probably running out.
Cool. Yeah, I hear you.
More ways than one.
Yeah, well, I would love to, I wanted to pick your brain if we had more time on what exactly the term post-breeding dispersal means, but I think we will save that for another time. Because we are running low, and Tony's got to go and do dad stuff. So thanks for your time today, Dan.
All right. Well, I don't know if you want to try to do some more talking after Tony takes off, but I'm available.
Yeah, why don't you guys do that? Why don't you record on your own, and we'll put all three together. We got some gold here.
Yeah, cool. Well, it's good to talk to you, Tony, and good luck.
Thanks. Dad, thank you so much. Cheers. I'll be in touch.
Yeah, good burden.